Well, welcome everyone to the new program, and also I want to really welcome everyone. It's 7 o'clock here in the evening on the west coast of California. 6 o'clock, actually. And I know that at other parts of the world, it's very, very late at night, 3, 4 o'clock. Other places, it's extremely early in the morning. So whatever time it is for you, I want you to feel welcomed, even if you feel a little bit tired or blurry-eyed. We all come here together, and again, by reading, you know, your emails, hundreds of them, really, since the course began, I can really sense how vital and important this is to so many of you. And I take it in that same light for me as well. As I said, I think on the first program of this course, that I had decided before it even started that I was going to speak with as much straightforwardness and candor and honesty about this whole subject of the experience of no self and what unfolds in the wake of that as I could, because I think often that the way it's spoken about is overly philosophical. A lot of it is almost kind of cliche or trite, even. Words and terms are sort of bandied about, I think, often without deep understanding of what they are, of deep experience of having lived those out. And so I really want this course to be really about the fundamental lived experience, and that's really been the aim of this whole course, and it will continue to be through the end of it, the real lived experience of what this is really all about. And of course, the way that the lived experience of life beyond self shows up is also very unique from one person to the next. You know, as I've said before, that each person's unfolding, their own revelation, is very unique to them, although there are some great commonalities to all of this, as there is to all of one's spiritual journey. It's in many ways it's quite universal in I guess you could say the big steps or the big phases. But how each of those occurs for each person is quite unique. And you know, no teaching or set of teachings can address all of those little unique qualities for each person. And so we also always have to take a teaching in and, you know, not mold it to the point where it's no longer what it began as or what it was intended to be, but to mold it in a way that really speaks to our own unique ways that spirit unfolds to us and within us. This evening, I thought I would sort of, it feels like diving in. You know, I keep talking about diving into the deep end, but this is kind of really diving into the deep end in a certain sense this evening, because I really want to explore a little bit about the actual lived experience and the expression of life beyond self. And of course, that includes many of the things people have written in about, whether it's, you know, what practical kind of doing looks like. You know, where does your doing, where does activity, where does action, what generates it, where does it arise from, what is the quality of the expression of our actions in life, the way we move in life. And of course, this also includes the way we relate to each other, the way we relate to strangers, to friends, to lovers, to people in the work environment, the whole arena of relationship and human relationship, I think, is a very, very profound part of this, as it is a profound aspect of all of daily life for all human beings. Before I get into that in a really concrete way, I guess you'd say, I wrote something down. I think I mentioned last time we met here, and I was talking that I was saying often in the 3 or 4 hours before I'm going to come on and do this live presentation and share this time with you, that I often get sort of, I don't know what you would call it. I get informed, let's say. I don't want to make it too abstract sounding, but I get kind of informed of what the course is going to be like. It just sort of starts to happen, and it just kind of almost sort of downloads into my system, and I'm often, you know, start writing little bits here and there, and these often, you know, once I start to talk, I don't talk or read from necessarily the things that I've written, but they work their way in. But I thought I would start out this evening by doing something that I very, very rarely do in any time that I teach, which I want to read to you just a little short two-page little piece of writing that has to do with this evening. It has to do with a number of issues around this. And I think what I'll do is just kind of read through it, and then I might come back and give little points of clarification to a few things, and then we'll move on to the bigger issue of relating from this place beyond self. Actually, this writing that I wrote is all about relating from beyond self, but it's so direct that it's funny. Sometimes the most direct things are the hardest to understand, because they are directness, I think, is not something that we're used to. We're not used to experiencing it. We're not used to hearing it. So we'll just see how this feels to you. And as I said, this came out of really getting clear this afternoon on what this evening's topic was going to be about. To die to all self is to relinquish conscious awareness to that light which shines only as divine darkness. For that dark light is eternal void. It is the devourer of all selfhood, an I-ness and me-ness, both finite and infinite. That dark void is the light of eternity. It is all without distinction, infinitely full in potential and expression, infinitely void in its substance and ground. That which is non-material is itself the material existence of all created things. Neither here nor there, it stands always before your eyes. It moves from an unmoved place, without cause or reason, but always in perfection. It is grace, not given or received, but grace as it is unto itself. For in that death of all self, we neither give nor receive, but become what eternally is. To die into that dark light is an annihilating death to all selfhood, but a birth into the ever-abiding ground beyond all distinction. And that ground moves as divine knowledge and love incarnate. When there is divine knowledge and love, the ever-abiding ground shines with brightness. And where there is not true knowledge and love, that ground shines not and is subdued by egotism like the sun during an eclipse. So let us humanly abide in a humble and loving heart, never forsaking the divine knowledge beyond all distinction, nor the infinitely loving heart of God, which is our own. In some ways, it probably is going to sum up the whole evening. Just a few things about this. There is often an experience that many people have written in about, many people have talked to me about over the years. I've been in discussion with people at the very moment it's happening. It often gives rise to a great kind of fear, great kind of hesitation. And that is when we experientially open to a kind of dark light, a voidness, which seems to, it feels like it's an annihilating presence, that if you let yourself go into it, that you would just never come back, you would never, that you would just be annihilated. And of course, at that moment is when many, many, many will pull back instinctively, whether they kind of consciously decide or not. The survival instinct will kick in and they'll pull back from that dark light, from that annihilating void, and they'll come back into their selfhood, relieved that they weren't devoured, but also strangely anticipating and desiring to come to that point of reckoning once again. It's strange how one can be so repelled by something and so drawn to it simultaneously. And yet, what seems like a complete void to self, an annihilating void to self, and in many ways it is an annihilating void because it's annihilating the last vestige of selfhood, self-consciousness, you could say. And as I've said before, this is not just taking away all the uncomfortableness of the human condition, all the sadness and sorrow and despair, but it's also a dropping away of so many of the sacred and beautiful spiritual experiences and states that we've experienced, from bliss to unity and beyond. And yet, only when we finally relinquish our hold, through unreserved desire for truth, for an unreserved yearning to know what lies on the other side of that vital encounter with void. That's what pulls us through. That unreserved yearning to know. And when finally that letting go takes place, that moment, we as a self, as an ego and also as a self, even an infinite self, disappear. In fact, it's very likely that all experience, even consciousness and awareness, will disappear. And you will only notice the disappearance after you come back from it. But in that disappearance is the possibility of the falling away of self. And then there's the resting, the acknowledgement, the realization, the understanding of that ground of being, that ground without distinction, with absolutely no otherness, that ground which is beyond all experience. And that ground, which is fundamentally void, is also a kind of infinite potential. And that which is infinite potential is not itself a material thing. It's not a material substance. However, it is the actual material existence of all created things. It's not simply an essence within things. It's not the presence within all things. It's actually the material existence of all things. I know that sounds contradictory or paradoxical, that the material existence of all things is itself non-material. But Such is the case. And in that relinquishing of self, as I said, we do not receive grace. We are not given grace, because all experiences of receiving or giving are based either in ego or self. Instead, we become the very, we see, let's say, we see from the eyes of grace. So there's nothing given, nothing received. There is seen from the eyes of grace. From the heart of grace, you could say. And so, again, paradoxically, we become at that moment what we eternally are and have always been. And still there is the necessity of becoming what we have always been. As I've said before, deeper we move into the lived encounter with the deepest, most fundamental nature of reality, the more paradoxical it becomes. To the mind, to experience, it doesn't seem paradoxical at all. It is just simply so. But to the mind, it seems extraordinarily paradoxical, contradictory even. And so there is a kind of, there is a divine knowledge that recognizes itself. The divine knowledge is the knowledge of non-distinction, non-otherness, no level at all of otherness. Not even the most beautiful forms of otherness. And that knowledge is received in full, and also the reality of a selfless love. A selfless love is not human beings running around trying to act selflessly. I mean, that's a perfectly noble endeavor at a certain state in one's development or consciousness. It is better to act selflessly than to act selfishly. But I'm not talking about the desire to act selflessly. I'm talking about the simple experience of actually being selfless. And that has its greatest expression in the expression of love. And selfless love is selfless. It's not the image of selflessness. It's not a self trying to be selfless. It's actually simple, selfless love. And selfless love is a quality of love that arises from the very ground of being, the ground of being that's beyond all distinction. It's even beyond love. But what arises from that ground is a selfless love. It's a selfless love is a love that one cannot, literally cannot turn off. There's, in other words, there's no option in it. It's an indiscriminate lover of what is. That it loves what you humanly like and what you humanly don't like so much, what you would prefer or not prefer. It's an indiscriminate love that cannot be turned off. It cannot be denied. It cannot be held back, no matter what. It's not the same as falling in love. You fall in love, you can fall out of love. You give love, you can pull your love back. But this love, the selfless love, the love that comes directly from the ground of being, there's no choice in it. It's like the sun. It just is what it is. It just is a love that just is. It just shines. And so there are some amazing, beautiful qualities that come from this most fundamental knowledge and love. Absolutely beyond our imagination, really. Not beyond in bigger, but beyond in unimaginably simple. Almost unimaginably, almost unimaginable. And yet, one can never possess it or hold it, utilize it, because to do so needs a kind of certain separation to hold something, to utilize it, to be in relationship with it, with this love or with this knowledge. All that requires a degree of selfhood. When self has really fallen away, there is no using it. There's no using knowledge or love. There's just being it. And as I try to emphasize many, many times over and over, that the being of it, we can have no image of what that's going to look like. I'm not portraying any image of a saintly person or even a holy person. A person that conforms to one's spiritual and religious ideals. To go beyond self is to go beyond all that. As beautiful and noble as it may be. As I often keep reiterating, it's a kind of return to an absolute kind of simplicity. It's an ordinariness in a certain manner of speaking. It's an extraordinary ordinariness. If you want just to be extraordinary, stay in the higher dimensions of self, where you're expanded, where you see yourself in everything, where, you know, there's a great sense of unity and you know, many, many other beautiful, beautiful, of course, there's many, as I said last week, there's kind of certain kinds of spiritual powers that become available at the higher dimensions of self and all that. But when we go beyond self, when it finally falls away, it doesn't express itself through all those sort of powerful dynamics. In fact, it's quite easy to miss. Not if it's alive in you, but, you know, one wouldn't necessarily walk up to you and go, "Oh, gee, my dear boy, I can see you have no self." So nonetheless, let's kind of look into a little more this area of the living experience, which I've touched upon, the expression of life beyond self. Before we get to more of the relating aspect, I also want to talk about just the kind of practical doing. You know, I get lots of questions in my role of teacher of people, you know, how do I know how to do this or how do I make this decision? Of course, when the personal will starts to fall away, what moves me in life when I don't have the personal will? What moves my practical doing, you know? Getting up, going to a job, you know, relating, caring for the family, all that. What really moves me? And of course, the transition periods, as I've already mentioned during this course, can be disorienting, and you may go through phases where it seems like, you know, there's nothing to draw upon, as I've counseled, however, it's useful to actually realize that you can move, you can do, not from personal motivation or even personal energy, that you can move and do from, well, number one, you can move and do from necessity. You can move and do from love. Do you know? Love for your life, love for, if you have a family, your family, your wife, or your husband, or your children, or your friends, or whoever. There can be a moving from love, which is not really the same as a kind of personal motivation. It's not that you want anything out of it. You're doing it as an act of love. But as self really falls away, doing, practical doing, becomes actually quite simple. And a lot of times, you know, I know the mind kind of wants to think about, like, how do I do that? You know, but you can't do moving from non-doing. You can't, self can't do what only no self can accomplish. You see what I mean? So it can be hard to you can't really completely translate any of this into directly, you know, stuff that self or ego can utilize. But nonetheless, from that dimension which is beyond self, as I often say when I teach, you know, it just that the reality moves in just the most obvious ways. It just does the next most obvious thing. And it's happening for you, that's available to anybody, no matter what state of consciousness you are in, to do the next most obvious thing. It's just that so often we're entrapped in various forms of identity. We're not simple enough. We're not clear enough. We're not quiet enough to see just what the next obvious thing to do. If we have a bunch of personal motivations in there that are fighting and vying for position, then we can't really see what's the next most obvious thing to do. In fact, we may not even want to know what the next most obvious thing to do. We only want to do what we want to do. See? But from the dimension beyond self, from that ground of being beyond all distinction, which is in each of you, which is each of you, one of the most obvious ways it moves, and I mean practical moving day to day, is it does the next obvious thing. It does not necessarily move from causes and reasons. It moves from something prior to causes and reasons. Something else moves it. What that is, what that something that moves it is not something that we can really, you can't put it into words. You can't control it. You can't do it. You just notice it. Oh, something seems to simply know what to do the moment it really needs to know what to do. It just knows. When ego and self aren't in there vying for position, that simple knowing becomes more and more and more obvious and more simple. And when we're not in our mind trying to figure it out, or so disoriented by it all that we're believing our anxious thinking, there's actually a way in which there's like an inner movement. It's a very simple and beautiful thing, do you know? It doesn't have whys, though, and it doesn't have guarantees, and it doesn't say, yes, everything will be okay, and it doesn't tell you, yes, you can be certain that this is the truth, you know. None of those certainties and guarantees, that's not how reality moves. That's more human mind stuff. That's our understandable questions, but they're questions that are fundamentally based in a kind of existential anxiety. The realm beyond self has no existential anxiety at all. As I said, it's always there. But generally, we just never choose it. Nobody's ever told us it's there. Nobody's ever taught us. Nobody's ever suggested to us that there is a dimension of our being, of our actual experience, that has no anxiety, holds no weight, has no psychological dilemmas, doesn't see life through that lens, doesn't hold to everything as if it's its own. There is something else within each being, however. It's always there. It moves from a profound simplicity, a quietness. It moves in the absence of personal motivations and ambitions. That's why, as long as we're tied up in our personal motivations and ambitions, we can't, it's hard to, not that we can't, but it's very hard to access it. And so life does move in the absence of sort of motivation. For instance, what I'm doing here now with you together, doing this course, or my teaching work in general, I really don't feel an inner compulsion to do it, an inner motivation. I don't feel like I need to share my message. I don't feel like I need to talk about it. Never occurs to me that anybody else needs to hear of it, as if they'd never heard of it, that somehow they would be hopelessly lost. Those kind of things never occur to me. There's no evangelical fervor whatsoever. It is simply what life does. And that's all. Why is this happening? Why do I do this? It's simply what life does. Beyond that, there really is no reason to it. There's no alternative purpose. There's nothing that I am hoping will occur or happen. Nothing inside that I feel like I have to get out. I can guarantee you when, you know, sometimes I go month and a half or 2 months in the summers without teaching. I feel no compulsion to do it whatsoever. And yet as soon as we are here, as soon as we are here together, it happens with great, great energy, with great conviction. It needs no personal motivation. It needs no personal impulse. In fact, it happens much more simply and beautifully and cleanly without all that. And that same thing exists within each of you. It exists within everybody. It's not that some people have it, some people don't. So I've said there's no hierarchy in all of this. It's really just more a matter of not even access as much as where we're living from. Granted, the transition from the dropping away of the personal will into what I'm talking about can be quite confusing, can be quite disorienting. Most people they'll grapple around a little bit with it, or a lot with it, for many months or years before it all kind of falls into a natural simplicity. It doesn't have to be that way. Sometimes it doesn't take that long for people, but, you know, in general, seems to, for most people, it takes quite a few months or years to really have it so fall into place. So it shouldn't be too upsetting, or at least I hope it's not too upsetting, that things don't just immediately, everything about living from no self doesn't immediately become totally clear. It finds its way, and part of it is it's really helped along when there's kind of a deep trust in that which is beyond all self finding its way through your humanness, through your human expression. That there's a trust that it can do that. It may not do it like snapping your fingers. You know, a revelation can happen like that. An insight can occur like that. But for the fullness of that revelation to embody itself through your humanity rarely happens that quickly. And I speak about this not because I can't tell someone how to do it any more than you can tell anyone how to walk when they're learning to walk, how to ride a bike when they're learning to ride a bike. You can't tell someone how. You can encourage them. You can say, well, get up and just almost like trust the process. Something knows how to find its way. And if you just keep getting up, you'll find that it does find its way. I can do that. That's what I'm hoping, you know, through talking about this, that this occurs for some of you, if not all of you. That there is something inside that you can trust, even though you can't understand it, you can't manipulate it, you can't make it happen. You can come into a deeper state of trust. And even, you know, and of course, most people will still have certain kind of pockets of confusion or hesitation or their own fears given their upbringing, what has occurred for them. It's not at all unusual that even in the state of no-self that some of those, there are some things that still have to be seen through so that this divine knowledge and love can embody itself through your humanity. So part of this is seeing, not, one shouldn't so much ask, how do I do it? How do I move from the divine ground, but see where the natural impulse and the natural movement coming from the ground, divine ground, gets impeded by, you know, whether it's a old pocket of fear or distrust or thought or whatever it is. Okay, now when it comes to relating, because this is an immense subject. Maybe someday I'll do an entire course on just sort of human relating from the divine ground. But so I can't, you know, it's such an immense topic that we can just touch upon it here. But one of the most important things to realize is even somebody who has a deep grounding in no self, that does not mean that they know how to relate from it to other human beings. That does not mean that they know how to relate from it. You can have someone in a state of no self that really doesn't know how to relate to other people very well at all. It's not only possible, it actually often happens. So we should not take in too many sort of idealistic ideas into all this. We have to, I think we're best served if we're in a state, a living state of discovery, constant discovery, rather than a state where we are projecting our imagination into the future, you know? There is always a human component, isn't there? No matter how deep our realization goes, no matter how much self completely drops away, there's still a human component. There's still a human being existing. And that human being is, well, it has its own humanity to it, doesn't it? Of course, when we open to the ground beyond all self, it opens up the possibility of relating from that ground. But it doesn't guarantee that it will happen. It opens up the possibility. One of the most simple ways I can talk about it, however, is there's two aspects of life beyond self. And one of those is the divine knowledge. The divine knowledge is the knowledge of no distinction, no separation, no otherness. Now that's, you know, philosophically, that's bandied about in spirituality all the time very easily. You know, no separation, no this, no that, no otherness. And, you know, it's all, it can almost come off as quite casual. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of actual life, of a moment of relating, that's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? That's where we see how well, how deeply have I realized this truth and how integrated is it into my humanity. When I relate with other beings, human beings, let's say, do I relate from them from this divine knowledge, from that ground beyond all distinction? Do I relate from that ground? Is my way of relating an expression of that truth of non-distinction, non-otherness? Do you see? That's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? That's where we get to see how embodied that reality has become. And also that's where we get to see anything that is inhibiting that expression, because that's the whole point behind embodiment, is to see any point, any way that is you're being inhibited, that's inhibiting that love. Because that's the other part of it, is there's divine knowledge, which is the knowledge of the abiding ground beyond all distinction, of the infinite. And the other aspect is selfless love. If someone wanted to know, how do I relate from a ground beyond all self, I would say, through love. Sounds almost cliche, doesn't it? Overly simplistic. But that's only because we're not used to thinking about love in a deep way, in a profound way. Sometimes we're used to thinking about love in a spiritually idealistic way. But as far as I'm concerned, that's not particularly deep or profound. What's deep and profound is how that love moves. As I said, selfless love is a quality of love that you can't turn on and off. You can't give to some and withhold from others. It doesn't work that way. So if one is embodying that love, you embody it to the exact degree to which you do not give it to some and withhold it from others. This does not mean that, you know, everything goes, or that you become a doormat for, you know, every deluded person that wants to take advantage of you. Quite the contrary. As I like to point out to people quite a bit, is that, you know, someone like Jesus was not a doormat for anyone. He could say no just as easily as he could say yes. So this isn't about a kind of love that is silly, a kind of love that is overly idealistic. This is where love and knowledge come together. Love and truth. Love and wisdom. Love and wisdom must be married together in order to relate from the ground, the ultimate ground of being. Love and wisdom must unite, because they are actually one force, one expression. You know, like on one side is selfless love, on the other side is divine knowledge, wisdom. There, it's one movement, one thing. So I do not think we find much clarity or understanding by saying, here's how to do it, or saying too much about here's what it looks like, because all these form images. And then the mind goes about trying to conform itself to those images, which is a great way to move far away from truth. As soon as your mind starts to try to conform itself to some image, you're moving away from that truth, not towards it. So I don't think to create more images of what all this looks like is in the end the most useful thing. I think what's more useful is to start from the divine ground itself, from that ground beyond all distinction, that ultimate reality of the infinite, to look from its eyes, to see from the eyes of eternity, to see from the eyes of divine knowledge, to see from the eyes of love, not from the eyes of a self that's trying to apply these things, but it's seen from those eyes. Then the question of how to do this becomes irrelevant. The only thing that becomes relevant becomes, is there anything that impedes the natural expression of non-separation, the natural expression of divine love, selfless love? What impedes its expression? And are you willing to let go of what impedes its expression? Because the truth of the matter is, most human beings literally do not want, they do not desire really to let go of what impedes the natural movement of wisdom and love. They do not want to let go. They want to have wisdom and love and hold on to what impedes its flow. But this can never happen. Never, 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 never. Never. When seen from the divine ground, everything, everyone is that ground, and therefore has infinite worth, infinite validity, infinite dignity. And the natural outflow from eternity, from the infinite, from the void, the natural outflow is that love. If someone was asked to me, as they do, well, how do you do that? I wouldn't have the slightest idea where to begin to tell them. I have no idea how to do any of this. None. In that sense, I'm completely and absolutely ignorant of how to do any of it. The how is what fell away when the self fell away, that there wasn't a how. But there was a seeing from the divine ground of anything that impeded its truth, its wisdom, and its love. And that had to be seen, acknowledged, and let go of in the humanity. It's the humanity, it's the humanness that saw it, acknowledged it, and finally could let go of it. We do so when we can see from the divine ground and we see that it's not real. Anything that impedes that love and that wisdom is not real. There is no legitimate reason. And, of course, this, what I'm expressing, of course, is talk, right? And when each of you lives your lives And each of you relates to the next thing you're relating to. Environment, life as a whole, humanity as a whole, the next person you come in contact with. We all know that that's where it becomes very real. That's where it's become vital. That's where everything becomes important. That's where we see how much of our humanity has relinquished itself into the ground beyond all distinction, into divine knowledge, into selfless love. Because as I say, we all have a very human component. And don't expect your humanness to conform to your idea of perfection or anybody else's. It will not. But don't let that be a reason that you don't allow the deepest knowledge and the deepest love to flow through your humanity. Don't let that become an excuse. Well, I'm just a human being. No human being's perfect. That's right. You're just a human being. I'm just a human being in a certain sense. And no humanness isn't going to be absolutely perfect. Whatever perfection would be, I think all the ideas of perfection fall away when self falls away as well. But nonetheless, this isn't about being perfect at all. It's about being what you are. What you are is neither perfect nor imperfect. It's simply what you are. And seeing from the eyes of eternity. Not seen from the human eyes that's trying to embody and manifest eternity, but seen from eternity, flowing through, expressing itself, existing as your humanity as well. So one can't be said, here's how, no one can't be told, here's how to do it. I respect the dignity and sovereignty of each individual far too much to be so arrogant as to think that I could tell you how to do any of this. I can't tell you how to do any of this. As I said, any more than someone could tell you how to walk when you're learning how to walk or ride a bike when you're learning how to ride a bike. I can tell you it's possible. I can tell you you come into it by the doing of it. Do you know what I mean? And through the humility to recognize when something in your humanity is impeding the natural flow of wisdom and love. That takes a real humanity to be able to recognize it. To see it. Simply to recognize it. Not to judge it or condemn it, but to recognize it. And not simply to recognize it, but to really see into the nature of what's holding on. So that that knowledge gets into it, that love penetrates through whatever's holding on. Whatever is holding itself apart, and for any reason that it's holding itself apart. The complicating factor in all this is that I know that the more it's talked about, the more complicated it seems. But actually, the more it's actually lived, the more simple it becomes. You don't become an expert in complicated means of embodying reality. That's not life beyond self. you become more and more and more and more simple. And again, paradoxically, the more simple we become, the more wisdom we embody and the more love we live. It has a matter of how simple we become, not how intricate our understanding is. When we are truly as nothing, nothing impedes this flow of divinity. When we are as nothing, there is the realization of nothingness, isn't there? Different levels of realization of nothingness. There is the realization also of nothingness in the terms of no self, life beyond self. But there's also the willingness to be that nothingness at the moments that count. At the moments of human interaction. When our rigid somebody-ness suddenly wants to congeal itself, pull back from this love, protect itself, or attack. All of a sudden, one's realization of emptiness can go right out the window. And like that, you're very deeply in your somebodyness. It takes a kind of humility, a real sincerity, to really want to see this about oneself. And not just say, oh, I've realized emptiness and therefore da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's one thing to realize emptiness, it's a whole other thing to express it. To embody it. To not just realize it, but to be it. So we're realizing it from the inside of it, from the inside of it. So we've actually fully become what we've realized. That we haven't just realized something as a moment of insight, as a kind of piece of, you know, transcendent information. If we've actually are what we've realized. And it takes a kind of humility to see anything that's impeding that, anything that's getting in the way. It's why, you know, one of the real foundations of my whole teaching is to practice a kind of deep sincerity, a deep truthfulness, a deep honesty, not only with others, but also with yourself. It's the most challenging thing for a human being to do, to be completely honest and sincere with themselves. It's one of those things that sounds like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, that sounds nice, you know, sounds like something you'd read in a book and then forget about. But if you actually were to take it to heart, you see, when we take it to heart, when we hold it within our sincerity, then it becomes something very different. It's not just an idea anymore. It becomes something beautiful. In the modern age, you know, when the concept of God as other is breaking down extraordinarily rapidly. And of course, in the deeper states of realization, the experience of God as other breaks down as well. And what we've lost with that is something beyond ourself. The sense of something truly bigger. And although I'm not suggesting that we create ideas of bigger transcendent deities to relate to. Of course, as I said, that all falls apart in the deeper realms of awakening, in the deeper realms of realization, and certainly with when the falling away of self happens, the falling away of personal God falls right along with it. But still, to have a kind of a basic feel, even the ground of being, right, the ultimate ground of being beyond distinction, is infinitely more vast than ego or self or humanness, your humanhood. It's not other because there's no distinction in it. There's no otherness in it. But it's also infinitely vast. If we don't have this sense of something, of an infinite vastness, the egoic mind becomes its own refuge. Self becomes its own refuge. But this ground that I'm trying to portray, not just in words, I hope you get the sense of it, the feel of it. Whether you understand my words is of secondary importance to me. I can guarantee you that it's of secondary importance, but to get a feel for it, a sense of it. The human quality, for it to be in a state of devotion, devoted to something other than itself. Very, very, very important. Very important. We don't have to have an idea of some, you know, separate deity to get a sense of this, to get a feel of this. Because even in experience, here we are, experiencing this amazing, vast, dynamic breadth of experience, of multi-dimensional experience. We are multi-dimensional beings. That's a big word, isn't it? Multidimensional beings. It sounds so otherworldly. But if we look in experience instead of ideas, what it means to be multidimensional beings, which means we can experience multiple realities simultaneously. As I said, there is the ultimate ground of being beyond all distinction. There is that knowledge, that is divine knowledge. There is selfless love that flows out of that void, the void of eternity. Selfless love flows out, divine knowledge flows out. A humanness is an expression of eternity. And humanness, your humanness has its own kind of reality to it, its own experience. You know, you can be lost in the clouds of the divine ground. But when your wife or your lover or your children needs your attention and needs it now, they don't need you to be lost in the clouds. They need you to be here and present and being that divine ground here in your humanity. In a very real way. And that's its own reality. You know, the human expression of life is its own reality. And so we have these we are existing in these different dimensions of experience all at the same time. And they're each of extraordinary value and importance. And so often, especially in spirituality, the tendency for many is to, especially when they experience some wonderful heavenly realm, is they just want to be in that dimension of experience, and they don't want to deal with their multi-dimensional experience. They say, well, I like this dimension. It's very heavenly and it's blissful and it's lovely, and you know. And then when I go into the world, I have to go, you know, to my job, I relate to people, it gets more messy, it gets more complicated. I really prefer this heavenly state. And, you know, of course, the only thing that clings to that is self, either ego or self. That's what does the clinging. Truth doesn't do the clinging. The divine ground isn't what's doing the clinging. The divine ground recognizes itself in the entirety of this human experience, on all the ways that it manifests itself in the entirety of experience, and that's multidimensional. And eternity seeks to, if we can even use the word seek, these are all metaphors in a certain sense. Eternity seeks to recognize itself, experience itself, express itself, embody itself through all these layers of experience and perception. And this is what I mean where it takes great humility, you know. Because it's easy when talking about this stuff, you know, you can start to get rather full of yourself. You know? And so to embrace the entirety of human experience is extraordinarily important. So this is just opening up this subject a bit, of relating from and as the divine ground, the ground beyond all distinction. To relate from it is to relate from the wisdom of absolute non-separation, and to wait from the reality of a kind of boundless love, selfless love that flows out of it. That's how you relate, from wisdom and love married together. And as soon as that breaks down, as soon as for any reason you start to contract into something other than wisdom and other than love, it all gets quite confusing and confounding. But to see where that breakdown happens takes humility. To see what's been being held on to that doesn't really serve anymore, that's not really relevant anymore. To do that is an act of love itself, is an act of wisdom itself. And the realm of human relating is so vast and situational. You know, each situation is so extraordinarily unique that you can't take one big, you know, overly simplistic approach, except to see if you're relating from the divine ground. when you're not, problems will surely follow. So this isn't saying how to do it, because one cannot do that. But you can certainly see when you're not doing it. The how is actually something that's intuitively present within everyone. It really is. It's intuitively present. But we've got to be so empty of self, so empty of personal motivation, so that we can operate from that space, so that we can be what we are. And we can never hide behind our own realization. In spirituality, there's a lot of hiding behind a moment of realization. So, therefore, humility becomes all important. And it's one of the most amazing adventures of life. Is seeing life from the standpoint of eternity, from the divine ground. To live in the living discovery of how does that divine ground, how does eternity relate in all these dimensions of experience? How does it relate in all of these? This is part of the discovery of life, of living. And this is an endless discovery. Don't expect some line in the ground that says, finish, now you've discovered it all. You know, if you ever think you've discovered it all, well, then you've just deluded yourself again. It's endless. There's an endless capacity to embody this ground of being, to manifest it. It's one of the most amazing journeys of life. It can be one of the most challenging journeys of life too. But the challenge is what ultimately makes it so satisfying and so rich and so real. So let's see. We have a little bit of time left. Let me open up the phone lines. And feel free to give me a call. Hopefully I really want to take calls that really stay on the subject that we've been talking about this evening. I don't think there'll be any lack of people wanting to stay on the subject, because this is a really vast subject. And like I said, I can just sort of, you know, touch upon it. I can't really, like I said, we could actually do a whole course on just this. And maybe someday that will happen. We'll see how it all goes. But I think there's also an advantage in looking at this whole subject of living from and living as that divine ground. There's an advantage in it being not simplistic, but simple, by not overcomplicating it. Because when things get too overcomplicated, it takes you away from your intuition. You know, it takes you away from your own self-discovery. It takes you away. It starts the mind creating images and strategies. And while some of that may be useful in other realms of life, in the sense of, you know, when we're kind of still in egoic consciousness or other states of consciousness, but here in life beyond self, it takes a simplicity, because it is a simplicity. I understand that when people open to this kind of ground, they often don't see certain parts of relating from it really simple, but it's because they haven't become simple enough in themselves, empty enough in themselves. Why? I don't mean just simple in their realization or simple or empty in their realization, but I mean simple and empty in their humanity. Simple does not mean stupid. Simple actually requires the deepest, most profound quality of wisdom and understanding. That's the kind of simplicity I'm talking about. The simplicity that takes great simplicity to simply love. That's simple. How the form that takes at any one moment, the challenges that that might confront you with, may be, well, quite challenging. But each challenge requires us to get even more simple, more humble, so that we become more and more clear, more and more humanly connected to that ground. That's why I keep emphasizing the same qualities, simplicity and humility, you know, are very important. Very, very important. So it'll take a few moments for some of the phone calls to be answered by the screener and get put on my line, put on my computer screen here before I can pick them up. But I also want to again, to thank you for, you know, the emails I get. I'm getting literally hundreds of emails a week, and I'm responding to as many as I can. Of course, I can't respond to hundreds of emails a week, but I respond to the ones that I can, the ones that I feel are more relevant to this course, fully understanding that every question that someone writes into them, it's fully relevant to them. But I try to often find the questions that are more relevant to the course that we're on the line of inquiry that we have here. But I've been responding to an awful lot. And I really feel like those questions that are asked and my responses to those questions are a very important and vital part of the teaching of this course, because in those questions, the teaching then gets very relevant to the question. It gets specific. So, of course, people write in with the specifics of what they're experiencing, the specifics of what they're dealing with, and their specifics of their questions. When I give a talk, you know, I'm talking a bit more broadly, of course, but through those many, many emails I don't know how many I've responded to in the last couple of weeks, but probably somewhere between well over 100 for sure. Because there's been many days that I've, you know, posted 20 or more in a given day. And so, you know, there could be 125 to 175 responses already up there. So there's a great, you know, breadth of not only teaching in that section, but also people sharing their experience. And that can be as much a teaching as my response to what they shared. The sharing itself can often be extraordinarily revealing and informative, and I think a really positive contribution to this whole course. So I would really hope that, you know, if you haven't you know, looked into that area of the course, that I would encourage you to do so, because it's a really potent part of a potent way in which the actual lived realities of what this all are about get fleshed out a lot. So I'm really, really happy that you continue to write in, and please know that I respond to as many as I can, but I can never get to nearly all of them. And I hope you will really take to heart and really look at what we are discussing tonight, because this is one of the richest areas of realization, is the living of it, the living of it. And in the spiritual tradition that I trained in with my teacher, which was Zen Buddhism, Zen was kind of founded on the whole idea that it's one thing to have a realization. It's something entirely different to be able to embody and manifest it. And at least traditionally in Zen, there's always been great emphasis placed on one's capacity to embody and express one's realization. And I think that's one of the greatest things that I received from that tradition, from my own way, from the way my teacher presented the teaching of the importance of being able to embody and express what you realize. You know, it's a really profound gift to have that that transmitted, you know, through a given spiritual tradition or a given spiritual lineage. So I'm just really thrilled that could happen, and I brought that forward. It's informed my whole spiritual life. It deeply informs my teaching, even though I'm not teaching Zen Buddhism. That's not my intention to convey a particular tradition. You know, that's never been what I felt drawn to do. I felt more drawn to convey what I think various traditions are really ultimately pointing to, and to speak about that in language that is hopefully more accessible to more people. The thing about the Zen tradition, and I think many spiritual traditions, is that they do not often give personal expression, human expression, expression in the sense of here's my experience. That's not done in Zen. That's not done in many forms of spirituality. Mostly things are talked about in more, you know, philosophical terms. It's the truth of unity and non-separation and, you know, all these more philosophical ways of expressing it. And yet I think that to have the more experiential expressions, which are people saying, here's been my experience, here is what I am experiencing, is actually much more useful in many ways, much more practical to say, this is not just the philosophy of the ultimate reality. This is not abstract ways that the philosophy, but that the realization is put into abstract ideas or ideals. But this is actually the lived day-to-day, moment-to-moment experience of it. And I think that's what I always tried to convey in the teachings, and especially in this course, that's what I've really tried to emphasize, is the experience of this, the actual lived moment-to-moment experience of falling away of self and of no self. And I hope to encourage you, each of you, to stay focused on that, to stay focused on the lived experience, and much more secondarily on all the ideas that surround it and the philosophical ways of describing it, you know. They're much more instructive. So I've got a bunch of things blinking on my screen, but okay. I'm talking to my people in the other in the tech room. Yet, I guess you guys you'll just let me know when I can pick up calls, if ever. Okay. One hasn't been locked in yet. We'll see it though. What I don't think that probably most people would not imagine how much technology it takes to make this program go, and people dedicated behind the scenes to making this all happen. It's even to my mind, I've been doing this for I've been doing the internet radio for quite some 4 years or so now, and I'm still stunned by actual how much technology it takes to pull it off. And so anyway, here we go. It looks like I got somebody up on my computer, so luckily we can go to some questioners.
Yes.
Hello, Anne. Welcome.
Hi, Arya.
Hi.
I'm calling because I've just come up with exactly what you're talking about, where I feel like my relationship with my children is something I'm not willing to let go of,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm holding on to that in a way that is stopping me from letting go more deeply.
What does that mean, I'm not willing to let go of my relationship with my children? What does that actually mean? What's your experience of that?
Well, I think what it is that it's the one place in my whole life I've ever been able to love completely.
Yeah.
And fully.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I let go of the way that I know how to do that and where to do it, then I won't have that in my life anymore.
Ah, that's the fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the fear. And that's a very common fear, by the way.
Yeah.
And I would say 99 times out of 100, because I probably have heard the same thing said to me at least 100 times, 99 of those times it's said to me by mothers, by women. And I think it makes perfect sense to me that it would be something that women would be so concerned about, because women, of course, you're the life givers, right? You bring all of us into the world. I mean, men, obviously, we play our part, but we do not have other beings, you know, coming out of our bodies. And so I think there's a particular way that women relate to life that is different, even the way that women relate to children. To have that experience of really being a life giver is a very powerful and beautiful feminine experience, right? And it creates a really deep bond. And I think there's also these much more ancient connections, which is that, you know, historically, women have been the basically those that sustain the tribe, whatever the tribe is, right? Their family tribe, or when we were all living in tribal cultures, they sustained the relationships of the tribe. That was one of their profound responsibilities, is sustaining that. And I think that really, those old and deep and ancient sort of roles get transmitted down to us, you know, and you feel them very acutely. And then when you come to the edge where it's like you feel like in order to let go of self, you're really letting go of everything you know, of course, those fears kind of come back.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can't, how can I let go? And I have to be a good mother. I have to be loving to my children. I have to be there for them. And if I let go, God knows what will happen.
Right. And the kind of the irony of it, too, is that the amount that I've been able to let go so far has so enriched those relationships.
There you go.
Deepened them and made them way more loving than I ever could possibly
there
have
you go.
Been coming from my ego.
That's
so
right.
I see that.
Yeah.
But there is part of it is that caring for them. Part of it is the caring for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that the loveliness of that intimacy is just like nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, you know, each Well, you know, genders have their own different ways of things that get them to not let go all the way. And of course, even from individual to individual, it can be a very unique sort of experience, the quality and the reasons why we hold on that last little bit. I think it's really important that, like you said, your experience is already of letting go of ego. And when you do let go, it actually increases your capacity for love and intimacy. And I think that part of your experience is really instructive, because that's not something that somebody told you. That's something you've actually experienced. Granted, you know, when self lets go, it feels like a complete letting go. There's no way to know what you'll be like once you've let go. That's the thing that I think is frightening. However, some of the same truths apply, in the sense that when as you let go of self, your capacity for love and intimacy grows exponentially. You don't lose that. You just lose the kind of personal ownership like kind of qualities around it. And as we begin to let go of those, the capacity for love and the capacity for intimacy actually grows exponentially.
Yeah, and I believe that.
I know you do. I know.
You know, the thing that's funny too is that the huge push for me, I've been kind of dabbling in spirituality, and then when I had my first son, and he was about 2, and he started talking about his third eye, I just thought, I have to know what's true for him. I can't teach him what I was taught, because I don't buy it.
Yeah.
And so the big driver, I thought, was for my kids. And, you know...
Well, keep using that as a driver. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know...
For mama to completely and absolutely let go is going to be great for your kids.
That's probably true. Because they're getting to be teenagers.
But, you know, well, then it'll become even more of practical value if they're teenagers.
Exactly.
For sure.
And I think ultimately it was for me. Anyway, but part of that realization was, I think what I really wanted to do was be able to show them, here's what you do, and live it out from my ego. But now when it really comes down to it, I've come this far, and I do on a lot of levels really want to go all the way with it, but there is that piece that I think just said, I don't know that I really meant this when I started.
Yeah, you might not have. And listen, I never try to convince somebody. I'm not really trying to convince you to let go. I think we all do it when we're ready. And I think my observation is there is a timing to this. There's an appropriate timing. And when the time is right, we'll just be inclined to really completely let go. And if the timing's not quite there, then it's entirely appropriate that we don't let go quite yet. The timing has to feel right for you. That's why I always say no one should feel pushed into it. They shouldn't even push themselves into it, much less allow anybody else to push them into it or convince them of it. It's something that's naturally arises within you. You know, when the time is right, I do think that it is helpful when you see that it's not really just a personal thing. You're letting go is not just a personal thing, that it is an act of love. It also becomes a gift to the people and the world around us, because it increases our capacity to love truly selflessly and very, very intimately. So I think although I'm not trying to convince you, because I totally respect anybody's sense of timing with all this, but I think it can be really important to see this in broader terms than, you know, what it is for us, to see that it is also an act of love or an act of service that we do for all the beings around us. And I think when that gets sort of hooked up in our heart, you know, that it is an act of love. It is something that's good on all levels. Then it becomes much more easy to let go.
And that kind of ties in other parts of my life too. And I honestly think that the reason I have this realization now is because I'm ready to see it.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've been kind of stuck for a long time not seeing that.
Yeah.
And I think that awareness coming in now is saying, okay, you know, this is where you're stuck. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to go with that. And I'm going to say, okay, yeah, because when I realized that, I felt like, but it's funny because on one hand I felt like, oh, yeah, I am stuck there. But just hearing you say I don't have to kind of freed me up in a way to say, okay, then it's a choice. It's not because it's the next step and I have to take it.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So just if I can just talk this through with you a little bit. So, okay, so if I'm ready to let go, and you talked earlier about that being just sort of an instinctive, intuitive feel. So I guess that's sort of the idea, is just to, you know, you talk in the your book, The Way of Liberation, about your aspiration.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's kind of where that goes, right, is saying, okay, so this shifts my aspiration to say, okay, yeah, let's see what that is.
Yeah. Our aspiration generally matures, you know, over time. And it may not start out this way, but as it matures, our aspiration will eventually mature into, I mean, these are just words, everyone has their own experience, but it will mature into sort of just, I call it an unreserved or an unconditional yearning for what reality really is. And what I mean by unconditional, I mean when that intention becomes unconditional, that we're no longer putting conditions on it. We're no longer saying, well, as long as it ends up this way or as long as it ends up that way, or, you know, that's conditional. But when it really matures, we just find ourselves feeling like, yeah, you know, it's unconditional. I don't need it to be a particular way for me. I just need to really come into the full flowering and realization of what it is. That's really what I need. That's really what I want. And that's just a maturing of one's intention, you know. And of course, I mean, I do this as I did with you. I do it with people all the time, to be quite honest. And I would suggest you and anybody listening to this can do it for themselves. It's funny, when we give ourselves total permission to hold on, if you just go, okay, I can hold on forever. It's okay. You know, nobody's going to judge me. God really doesn't care. You know, it's perfectly fine. I can hold on as long as I want to. It's funny, when the permission is really given, the permission is really received, it actually invokes that deeper impulse. Something in us goes, well, now that I've got permission, I'm not so sure that that's what I want to do. I'm not so sure that I want to hold on now that I've got permission to hold on. You know?
I felt that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny how that works, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a very human thing, you know? It's like when someone, you know, says you have to do something, we tend to not want to do it. You know? And when someone says, you know, I really don't care if you ever do it, it's perfectly fine, I love you just the way you are, then often we go, well, geez, now I'm a bit more interested.
You have the freedom and the choice.
That's right. Because I think it speaks to something. It does speak to the freedom within each of us. And it also speaks to the dignity within each person, where we are not assuming that we know what someone else should be doing. When we speak to their own dignity of their own experience, then then they can access their dignity even at a deeper level, you know? And I think it's really important with anything in life, but it's certainly with spirituality, I think there's often a kind of not really acknowledging the dignity of the individual. There's always telling the individual what they have to do and what they should do and what they need to do and, you know, all these things. And all often that's kind of denying the inherent dignity of the individual. That when they're ready, they'll do it on their own. They don't need to be pushed. And that their own timing is perfect for them, isn't it? It's perfect. You know, we hold on as long as holding on serves us. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. When it stops serving us so well, then we let go. It's rather simple in the end.
That sounds very simple.
Yeah. And thanks for calling.
Anya, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I really enjoyed talking with you.
You too.
Good okay. Night. Bye. Yeah, it is... It is amazing how often I hear from women, especially mothers, that thing in them, that deep, deep, compassionate, loving, mothering instinct that says, you know, I can't let go because, you know, I can't be certain that I will be, you know, the person I want to be for my children. It's very very intimate and profound part of I think that makeup. You know, and it's, I think it's very understandable. It's very understandable. And it has its own kind of nobility even to it, you know. But underlying it, I think, is often kind of an unconscious assumption or just a failure to really recognize that spirituality is not about letting go into an irresponsible state. If that's what ends up happening, then your spiritual realization has been derailed, actually. It hasn't gone into a state of maturity. That real spiritual realization actually takes us in the direction of more selfless capacity to love, more selfless capacity to be intimate, to be caring. That's the trajectory that unfolds. And if it unfolds in some other trajectory, it's generally a good indication that it's just gone off the rails, you know? The capacity to love and the capacity for true indistinction, non-separation, is an intimate part of the deepest and most profound realms of spiritual realization. I think knowing that can make it a lot easier to let go, can make it easier because there's an underlying sense of trust. You might even say a kind of faith grounded in reality. Okay, let's go to the last couple of callers. Let me go to Sand from Marin. Hi, welcome.
Hi, Adrian. Good evening. Hi there. My question is, you know, you've talked about this evening about... you know, this ground of being, and we live from that place. And my question is about, like, tears. Over the last few years, when I'm in what I'm imagining as a ground of being, there's this overwhelming energy, almost of like love, unconditional love, mm-hmm. and the tears just come, and they come, and then I don't know why they come, but mm-hmm. they can come, and my ego probably has a field day with that, because it's like I can judge that so mm-hmm. much. You know, I look at you on the screen, and you're so calm, and I can look at other teachers, and they look, and I just think, did the tears ever stop? Did the tears stop? And my ego says, oh, you've not even started this path yet.
Oh,
The heart opening. Is that ground of being that is causing it, you know, even now?
The spiritual heart is becoming very, very open in you, dear. And there's often, I mean, again, each person is very individual in how that is expressed and how that is experienced. And for you, that, you know, that those moments of deep poignancy. My teacher used to say, all love is bittersweet. True love is bittersweet. You know, it's like, it's so profound that it has that little bit of bitterness. That's the poignancy. That's where the tears come from. It's just so poignant, so intimate, so profound in its intimacy and closeness that it's one of the most natural responses to that depth of love. You know, will it always stay that way? Probably not. You know, it can go even deeper, but I would really not succumb to your ego's judging of the tears. You know, I mean, there are people all over this world that are desperately searching to have that quality of an open heart. That would give anything to experience that right now, do you know? And I would really just honor it and value it. You don't have to sort of, you know, grasp onto it and hold it, which you're not doing anyway, so you don't have to worry about that. But just let it, if that's the way it wants to express itself now or for months or years, fine. My teacher told me a story where she said, and this was even after she had started teaching, and she went to this, she found this lovely lady that she just loved kind of hanging out with, and she would go and they would do retreats together. And as soon as the retreat would start, that my teacher, she would just start, the tears would just start rolling down her face. And there she'd be there, you know, meditating all day long, every day, and she would just sit there with just the tears streaming down her face. And she didn't know why, and there was no story, and she wasn't sad. There was no, you know, big thought process. It was just, they were just streaming. And she said it did that every time she would sit down and be still at those retreats. And it happened for 2 years. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day, the tears just sort of stopped flowing. The love didn't stop flowing, you know. But the tears had just done whatever they were meant to do, you know. She didn't even ever say, this is what they were meant to do or anything like that. She never felt the need to even understand it. She had long since realized the usefulness of simply allowing experience to unfold. You know, I would just allow it to unfold. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you have tears. Beautiful. I mean, lovely. Absolutely lovely. You know, other people may go, what is she crying for? But
right.
That's okay. You know, most people don't understand us anyway, so, you know, why bother?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, isn't that lovely? And it's ironic, too, you know. Like I said, there are people struggling to open their hearts, and you know their defendedness in their hearts, you know, and you know, there you can be with your heart quite open enough to where just sort of, you know, tears come for no particular reason other than the heart is really beautifully open, and even the mind can kind of go, is this okay? And you know, when you're there, you are experiencing something that, you know, people would die to be experiencing, that quality of an open heart. And just the beauty of letting experience unfold and trusting it, you know. Nothing stays the same indefinitely, but just trusting it. There's a wisdom in experience being allowed to unfold. And that's not just good experience. That can be painful experience, frightening experience of all kinds. The wisdom of allowing your experience to unfold itself, to unpackage itself, is very, very important to know and to allow to live out. Okay, let's go to, hello, Jody, welcome.
Hi, Adya.
Hi.
Hi. My question relates to what you were speaking about earlier, when you find that you are relating
mm-hmm.
from the somebody-ness,
mm-hmm.
that the breakdown has happened, that you're not relating from that your yeah. truest sense, that ground of being.
Yeah.
And the humility happens where it's, and this happened to me today many, many, many times. So I can see sometimes immediately as mm-hmm. I'm relating from that place, it's conditioning, it's my somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of times I can see it very, very clearly mm-hmm. afterwards.
Yeah.
And I'm very much, this is what I'm interested in these days, is seeing this more and more and seeing through it.
Mm-hmm.
What my question is, what do you do with it when you
okay.
do
yeah.
see
yeah.
what, okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to give you what I think is the most fundamental. It's not the final answer necessarily for everybody, but it's really fundamental to working with this, I think, at all. And it's, which is, the first thing is, you know, when you notice your, you know, that you, the, when you start to relate from your meanness, from separation, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you might notice it right in the middle of the moment of relationship. You might notice it an hour later or a day later, whatever. Whenever you notice it, the first, when you see it, you just stop. You just stop. If you notice it at the moment of relating, even if it gets kind of heated, you just stop. And you acknowledge it to yourself. And often it's a good idea to acknowledge it to whoever you're with, too. You know, just stopping. And then the willingness to be really open. You know, I'm relating from a place that doesn't feel true to me, where I feel defended. And when I feel this way, I can feel myself cutting you off and cutting off from you. And that's not what I want to be doing. That's not what's really true for me. And at that moment, that's what I, when I, you know, use the words like humility.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. It's not some like spiritualized ideal of humility. It's like in the moment, can I see it? Can I share what I'm experiencing? Even if it's humbling, can I share it? Because then it's out in the open, right? Then I can make a different decision. Then I have immediately a different option when I share not only what's happening, but when I share that this is not what I want. This is not what I really want to say. This is not really what I want to communicate. Then at that moment, you have that instant to go, what do I really, really want to say? What's really true here for me? And that's a revealing, intimate moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just to share that is, I think, for most people, is revolutionary in relationship, to share that, to have that much transparency. And yet I think it's very, very, very important, because then we're including each other in our heart. In our what we want, and we're also including them in our admitting of our imperfection. Because I always say, you know, if any of us ever thinks we are so spiritually clear that we'll never have to say I'm sorry, then we probably already have a whole host of people we need to say I'm sorry to.
Yes.
If we ever get to that point where we think we'll never have to, that's the humility. I think the sharing of that can be really quite empowering, actually. Maybe frightening, you know. But you know, because we're so taught through a sort of model that says we have to sort of therapize all of our moments mm-hmm. of confusion. And don't misunderstand me. I think that for many people, therapy can do wonders. But I also think that there's moments, like you're talking about, when what's more important than figuring it all out and therapizing it and, you know, trying to solve it all within ourselves, why do I do that? Why did I do that? Which is in the moment, we just stop, acknowledge it, voice it if it seems like it's safe to voice it, because sometimes it will be and sometimes you'll feel like it's not. But whether you voice it or not, then have that, then you stop, you see it, you acknowledge it, and then you look at, what do I really, really want to be saying? And you see, there's no long process with that. That's just going it immediately to what's really, really true for you, what you really want to convey. You know?
Yes.
I mean, I think so often that the first thing that happens, you know, when a moment of relationship starts to feel like it's going off the rails.
Yes.
What happens is, and I feel in you, you can tell me if I'm wrong with this, but I just can intuitively feel that you can probably feel relatively quickly, the energetically, when you disconnect from somebody.
Yes.
Yeah, it's painful.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. And so when that moment of disconnect happens, and when you get really sensitive, you can actually feel the word in a sentence.
You
know what I mean? Yeah, and it's painful, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's like poison.
That's right. It is. It's like ingesting. And of course, the more conscious you get, the more acute that becomes.
Absolutely.
It doesn't become easier. It becomes more difficult. But the thing is, you don't only feel it, but the other person feels it too.
Yes.
They may not be conscious of it, but they feel it. And then because two people are feeling energetically separate, that tends to escalate, right, the conversation. Because once we feel separate, it takes someone to reach out and say, you know, I feel separate right now. And that's not really my intention. That's not really what I mean, want to convey. That's not really what is important to me. But usually neither person will do that because they're afraid of doing it. It's too much to acknowledge within themselves. It's too much to confess. It's too intimate of an encounter to have. And yet, there it is, isn't it?
Yes.
There's the opportunity for each of us. And that's a journey, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, you know, it's a journey. I often say to people, you know, start out with the small stuff.
Yes.
Don't wait till the big, huge moments to look at, to just track a like conversation and see when you start to feel a little bit disconnected. Start out with the really easy, casual stuff. And get the hang of it and get the feel of it and get the sense that you can actually kind of stop and pause for a moment and move things back on the track of your heart of what you really want to be saying. That you can do it in these, you know, in these conversations or these moments that really aren't, don't feel very intense. Then the pattern's set, right?
Yes.
Then you have some energetic groove or imprinting that when you get into the more difficult moments, at least the imprinting is there. You have a resource, you know? And sometimes you can do this even if you're sitting and you're thinking about someone and your self-conversation starts to get separating. Do you know what I mean? Oh, that person and so, and they said that. And it starts to escalate in your own head. And you can even just go, oh, you stop. That actually hurts. It's not right or wrong. It's not should or shouldn't. It's that it hurts. And what do I really, what's the conversation even in my own head? What's the conversation I really want to have? What would I really actually want to convey if I wasn't defending myself? You know, you don't even need to wait till a moment of actual encounter, because most people have encounters going on in their own mind day to day. And you just start there.
That is so helpful.
Yeah, because you can fall in love with someone all over again just in your own mind.
Absolutely.
Whether it's, you know, a friend or a lover or a family member. I mean, you can just, like, without even having a conversation, you can turn it all around just by your own self, realizing that your self-talk is painful to you and it's not really true. And that what you really want is that deeper connection to express what you really are, right?
That is so helpful.
Yeah.
It is.
Good.
It is. And that it is the small, it's amazing to me, the smallest encounters with people that just seem so insignificant are now just, it's so revealing.
Yeah. Yes.
I can see immediately just, it's no longer unconscious. Mm-hmm. It's conscious when I am relating.
Yeah.
From that me place.
Mm-hmm. Conscious and painful.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why I tell people, if you don't want this kind of unconsciousness to cause you more pain, don't even get involved in spirituality, because it'll make it actually worse, which ends up to be good, because then we finally can see it. And we can see it in the moment, and not just with our minds, but our physicality, like you said. It feels like poison.
It does.
So it's not even conceptual. You don't have to think about, now, am I going into separation? You know,
you know it.
You know it because you're, it feels like I've just ingested some awful poison.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that never used to happen, and now,
Right. Yeah. You just weren't aware enough to notice it.
That's right.
And it's difficult, but it's also amazing that you sense that there's the keys to not only my freedom but their freedom, not only my love but their love, our intimacy. There's the keys in my hand. And I never knew they were in my hand before. And they are. And then I can realign and see what's really important. Do I really want to win the argument? Do I want to insist that I'm being understood? Do I want to insist that I'm being acknowledged? What is that really? All that's very nice when it happens, but is that really at the end? Is that really what I want? Or do I want something deeper than that? Yeah. I'm so glad you called.
Oh, thank you.
I think we discussed this, not for you, of course, but I think for an awful lot of other people, too. Because we all live this, don't we?
Yes. The rubber hits the road.
That's right. This is it. This is definitely, definitely the rubber hitting the road, yeah. And there's no, although people do try to hide from this, they'll even use their realization to hide from it.
Yes.
In the end, reality that I've seen, it's not at all interested in hiding from any of this. In fact, it leans into it because it feels the immense possibilities of healing and transformation that come about through all this.
No more hiding.
Yeah.
Thank you, Adya.
You're welcome. Bless your heart. Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. All right. Well, really, really lovely set of calls. These are like great examples of also what happens in the whole blog area with the emails and the Q&A. Specific, people calling, people writing in with specific issues that we can really look at in a very pointed way. I think it's a really important part of our time here together and our time, like I said, when we're sharing our questions and emails back and forth. So we'll be here together next Wednesday to meet here and to encounter each other and to form this sort of virtual sangha. But the funny thing is there's nothing virtual about it. It actually is a moment of coming together in true community when we share this time together, when I share it with you and when you share it with me. And yet during this course too, there are many, many people that are participating in this that are living this inquiry, just like you are, throughout the days of the week, that this is a very alive and vital thing for them. So that sense of community sustains throughout the weeks, throughout this course, as we all share in this exploration together. So thank you for joining with me tonight. And many, many blessings to all of you. Namaste.